Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This week on the podcast, continuing my series of Greeks who have contributed to the culture, a Hollywood screenwriter famous for Beauty and the Beast, The Pope's Exorcist, The Huntsman's, Winter's War, and his self-written, produced, and directed horror debut, The Unholy, Evan Spiliotopoulos.
The perception of Hollywood towards me being Greek is great because we're very, very likable. I will say without a shred of doubt that being a writer means you're always the outsider. Trust me on this. What is it that they used to tell the Roman emperors when they would come in? Don't forget, you're still immortal. Deep down inside, we know the flaws in our story already, even if we're not brave enough to confront them. When you start off here and you're told it's good, but it's just not good enough, well, you really want to get up here.
Evan Spiliotopoulos coming up in just a second, but please do me a favor, subscribe. You see, I'm building an eclectic mix of interviews, and there's something in there for everyone. Evan Spiliotopoulos, welcome. Yassis. First
Hello.
Of all, you were born and brought up in Greece. What sort of cultural atmosphere were you brought up in?
Typical suburban culture of any nation on the planet. House in the country, small high school, and a lot of green, which, may I add, whenever I return to Greece, has now completely been taken over by the concrete empire that is Athens.
So what music, films, television were you into as a child?
I'm going to tell you a story about what kind of a little kid I was when I went and watched movies. You know how kids always cry in the movie theater? So the legend goes that I cried before the movie started. And as soon as the movie started, it was Asterix and Obelix animated French. And as soon as the movie started, I went silent. And then the minute the movie ended, I bawled my eyes out. So clearly animation was one. But I am very much a horror movie person. I'm very much an action adventure person. I'm very much an epic period piece person. Varied interests. I like all kinds of movies when they're good.
I think the first film that really had a major impact on me was when I was 16 and I went to see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I just sort of snuck in. I don't think I was really even allowed, but I managed to sneak in. And that film impacted me so much that it wasn't that I couldn't talk for a few days, but I was sort of taken over by the emotion of the film. Has there been a film in your childhood that has really impacted you in a way that you sort of can't move or think or do anything?
The Fox and the Hound, 1982, Disney. In fact, one of, I believe, John Lasseter's first credits as a board artist. And I may have seen it within a year. That year, I was 11. I may have seen it maybe 10 times. And remember, back then, at least in Greece, we didn't have VHS players. So I think I went to the theater repeatedly.
I mean, you left Greece quite young.
Yes.
Were your parents supportive of your decisions or were they worried for you?
My dad had passed away. So I lost him when I was 15, cancer. Everybody smokes in Greece, so that's why I've never smoked. But when I graduated high school, I immediately left for the United States, and my mother was fully supportive. Now, she's Greek American. So she was born in Gary, Indiana. Her side of the family was entirely in the United States. So she, for her, it wasn't like, oh, my child is leaving and going completely among strangers. No, it was basically he's going, but I have my brother and all my nephews are there. So it was still a family environment, fully supportive.
So you didn't feel a culture shock when you went to America, or was it partly a culture shock?
It was partly a culture shock for sure. Now, the thing is, I had grown up speaking English in the household, so I was completely bilingual. So it wasn't an issue of the language. It was, however, you know, it was the first time I had lived abroad 100%. And things, you know, Greece operates in a slower wavelength, a more relaxed wavelength, like you're permanently on vacation in Greece. And in the U.S., very quickly, I got accustomed to the fact that, no, things get done here.
Did you feel like an outsider in America at the start?
I once knew a Greek actress who was also half and half, Greek and American. And she told me something that completely resonated with how I felt. That when you're a child of a family of two different cultures, instead of belonging to both cultures, you actually feel a little bit of an outsider in both of them. So the answer is yes for me, and that's never changed.
I think that's fascinating because obviously my history is very much pop music, although I am a screenwriter actually, but not successful. Certainly not in the way that you're successful. In pop music, the outsider has played an enormous role. I mean, if you look at someone like David Bowie, it's completely about the outsider. And I'm just wondering whether the outsider, even a little bit, feeling like the outsider, plays a role in your determination, in your drive.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think that if I was in an environment where I felt completely that I belonged, I would get complacent. And I would get comfortable. And I will say, like, for 8 years so that I was a staff writer at Disney Animation, 2000, 2008, the environment was so warm and welcoming and fun that I definitely got complacent. And it needed the big shakeup that happened in 2006 when Disney and Pixar basically merged, that basically shook me out and sent me off to my live action career. I think being an outsider just motivates you. It motivates you to prove yourself. It motivates you to prove yourself to yourself as well.
I mean, at the university, though, you studied film theory. And I'm just wondering whether film theory, in essence, is still useful in your career today.
So I was an undergraduate in film theory, and then I got a master's degree in screenwriting. And I can tell you with absolute certainty that the film theory degree was far more useful and still is. And I will explain. So in film theory, they sent us to immerse ourselves into the evolution of the art form from its very beginning with the Great Train Robbery and the Méliès films and the Muybridge movies and all that down to, you know, contemporary cinema. So we got to see silent films. We got to see black and white films. We got to see foreign films. We got to see strange Polish and Czechoslovakian animated movies. A lot of executives and screenwriters think film begins with Star Wars. And I wish that was not true, but that is the fact. A lot of people who are in positions of power and positions of creativity in the industry don't know the evolution of the art form. So film theory for me was extremely helpful, extremely. The master's in screenwriting, you honestly can buy a how to write a screenplay book and learn formatting, learn structure, because to be fair, a lot of that isn't teachable. What's teachable is format, structure, and the basic elements of how to write a script. But then it's, are you a writer or are you not? So I could have done without that. And nobody cares in Hollywood if you've got a degree in screenwriting.
No, I mean, that's my experience too. This has nothing to do with anything. In my master's, I totally agree that the structure was the part that helped. But there was something else that I learned that you have to write.
Yes, yes.
So that was, you know, something that the bonus of going to university is actually learn you have to do it to be it, in a sense. How important is it for the deeper theme of a script to relate to your own personal experience?
I think when people give advice on writing and they say, write what you know, I have to believe that they're really referring to theme and the personal reflection that you will have in any given story, because otherwise creativity would be awfully limited. And we would never put ourselves in the place of imagination of, oh, I'm going to write a story about somebody in the 17th century. Oh, but I've never lived in the 17th century. So it has to be a reflection of a concept, an emotional choice, or a thematic idea that you have experienced in your life and want to further explore. And I find that that is very, very true very often. I mean, look, I'll just go to Beauty and the Beast, which granted is a story that I no way originated, given that it started in the 17th century. But the specific elements that I'd like to think that myself and Stephen Chbosky brought to the story were reflections of that fish out of water for both characters, and how two characters who don't belong in their own communities find a home with each other.
What things have been important in your life that you have discovered through screenwriting?
I think writers in general are supposedly very introspective and private. And I find that that's certainly the case with me. We're introverts. And I think that through my writing, I've actually gotten, it's actually a form of therapy, where I've actually become in my personal life more outgoing and open, because I've explored issues, as opposed to being on a therapist's couch, explored issues through my screenwriting.
I saw this brilliant T-shirt during the writer's strike, where this is a picture of a woman who was wearing a T-shirt which said, AI didn't have childhood trauma.
Genius. I saw that. It is one of the, that defined the entire struggle for me, and it's 100% true.
So you moved to Los Angeles, and you had a difficult period. Can you tell me about that period and how you survived it?
So I moved here in 1995, and for 5.5 years, I would say, to the early 2000, I got maybe two jobs in two sci-fi channel movies, but they were really under $1 million low-budget productions. I got 2 credits out of them, which was great. But it was very little work. I had no agent. And the clock was ticking on my savings from the money I'd made off those two movies. And of course, I couldn't, leech off my mom for much longer. And the thing that kept me going emotionally was that whenever I would write a spec, whenever I would come up with new material and send it out to whoever I could, I was always being encouraged. In other words, there was never the, hey, we took a look at it. Yeah, it's just not good enough, or it's not right for us. Or it was always like, dude, this is really good. It's just not what we're looking for. It's not as commercial as we'd like. And then people would be like, but that scene is great, and this character is great. So there was a constant stream of, no, you can do it. You've just got to stick with it. And I think if things had been otherwise, if I was sending material out and either never hearing back, or hearing criticism, like it just not good enough, I may have given up. But it was that constant validation that kept me going. And I will say that, as the universe often arranges things this way, when Disney hired me in 2000, I had enough for 2 months worth of funds. And I was starting to plan, because I did not want to leave. I was starting to plan to, like, if I get a job in the fast food industry, can I write at night? Is that enough to keep me going? And thankfully, Disney hired me.
So there was never really a proper plan B. It was something you had to succeed in a way.
There was an intellectually, a plan B was go back to Greece and become a tour guide. Why? Because I like telling stories. And I would be able to tell stories to people of, oh, here's the story of the place that I brought you to. But no, there was not a proper plan B.
William Goldman said that no one in Hollywood knows anything. My experience when talking to a lot of Hollywood executives, I mean, there are some that I feel not sure they really understood anything, but most of them really are really clever. How do you see it?
I'm going to tell you 2 stories, not from my experience. Robert Zemeckis, Robert Zemeckis, who I had the pleasure of having attached in a project once, told me that Spielberg had him, Scorsese, George Lucas, and a bunch of other close friends, imagine that room, in for a private screening of his movie E.T. in 1981. And Zemeckis hated it. And Zemeckis told him, I don't like E.T. His eyes are too far apart. He looks like a fish. The audience will never click with him. Well, we all know how that turned out. And this was Robert Zemeckis. And the second story is, I was recently watching a documentary, The Ghost of Richard Harris. And there's an interview with Jim Sheridan, when he was directing Richard Harris in the field, where there's a scene where Richard Harris's character, the bull, bares his soul for the first time. And Sheridan felt it was overacted, and Harris felt it was the best film acting he'd ever done. And the two of them did this, this, or this. And Harris finally got Sheridan to keep that scene the way it was in the movie. And De Niro, after the movie came out, said it was the best piece of film acting he'd ever seen in his life. And so you look at that going, it's Jim Sheridan. And even he was like, to this day, I don't like that scene.
So how do you decipher criticism? Because criticism can be tough. You know, you get a review of what you've written, and it can be negative, and sometimes it's very difficult not to take it on in an emotional way. How do you decipher criticism?
Well, I do take it in an emotional way, that's for sure, especially if it's something that's true and dear to my heart. I think instinctively, when a piece of criticism is relayed, that we kind of know, oh yeah. Someone had once told me that when I was studying screenwriting, that we, deep down inside, we know the flaws in our story already, even if we're not brave enough to confront them. Maybe we're not brave enough because it means more work. Maybe we're not brave enough because my cat is glaring at me because I'm talking to you. Because to solve them will mean we don't have the answers quite yet. I'm not sure, but I will say that whenever I've heard a piece of criticism that I like and I respond to, it's always something internally I go, you knew that. You already knew that. When I hear a piece of criticism that I don't respond to, it shakes me because I'm like, are they right? I don't feel that way at all. So you gotta pick and choose. You can't accept all because everybody has a different opinion. Everything's subjective. Anything from the reactions people have to the same glass of wine to the reactions people have to the same movie are subjective. So you cannot accept everybody's opinion.
You mentioned the period where you worked for Disney, and I assume that was a period that gave you great confidence and that changed your own perspective of what you were doing and what you were writing. Is that true?
Oh, gigantic. First of all, my standing in the business, aside from my feelings, my standing in the business, the moment that Disney approves you, even if it's animation, it doesn't matter. A studio, that big of a studio has given you its seal of approval. Now you're in the game. Now you can sell or work for any of the other studios. So that was one. Secondly, it was the financial stability. I mean, you're a staff writer, you're getting a weekly paycheck. And that for me, which is the first time in my life that happened, especially as a struggling writer for 5 years, huge. And it allowed me to get a home and, you know, form a basic structure of, okay, LA is now my home. I'm actually staying here. Emotionally, it was gigantic because, again, it was validation of those 5 years of struggle. It was a validation of, am I a writer? Do I have what it takes? So that was great. Finally, it was the best training ground. I mean, I was joking about how useless the master's degree in screenwriting is, and it is, but 8 years of being a staff writer, be it Disney, be it television, be it whatever, that is boot camp for a writer. So they actually taught me how to pitch material, which is super important in Hollywood because a lot of things sell off pitches. And I, later on, in the last 5 years, actually, I've done some producing, and I am startled at how poor some writers are at pitching. And you'd think that there's an opening for some kind of lesson, some one of those Robert McKee types to actually teach how to pitch, because it's a huge tool and not many people have it. But in any case, they also taught me how to translate the pitch into a proper screenplay, producible screenplay. They also taught me to balance budget considerations with imagination. That is less important than animation, where you can do anything. But it is still, you have to know, like, Disney Animation does $100 million, $200 million movies. My division did up to $20 million. So you have to adjust for that. But it helped me later on in live action, where basically I like writing big, and sometimes, well, our budgets aren't quite that big. So it was a turning point on many ways.
When you write something, I mean, if you compare animation to live action, they're both in worlds, and they both have rules of their own worlds. Animation has different rules, obviously, to the live world. Is that what appeals to you about animation, that there is some greater freedom in what you can write?
Yes. In essence, they're all about characters and they're all about plots. So it doesn't matter what the format is. It doesn't matter if it's animation or live action. Just as it doesn't matter what genre you're writing in, it's still fundamentally a story about people facing choices, no matter what it is. Is it a Western? Is it horror? Whatever. But in terms of the freedom of imagination, look, it clearly can do things in animation that you just can't do in live action, both to your characters and to the world. I mean, I think the closest live action film I've ever seen to animation was actually Richard Fleischer's 1967 movie, Forbidden. Is it Forbidden Journey? It's the one where they go, the scientists are scrunched down and go into the body of a dying scientist. That has been done in animation in later years, but to do that in 1967 as a live action movie is extraordinary. And that just goes to show you that's kind of film where those two worlds met.
According to Christopher Booker, there are seven types of stories: Overcoming the Monster, Rags to Riches, The Quest, Voyage and Return, Rebirth, Comedy and Tragedy. Now, when you get a job to write a script, what is your process? How do you approach that story that you identify, and how do you tell it in an original way? How do you make it original?
It's always the character. So let's say it's an original screenplay. I mean, the natural way is put characters in extraordinary circumstances. And those can be anything from the world's ending in a science fiction movie to a marriage's ending, which is the world's ending in a domestic canvas context. It's putting those characters in extraordinary situations, creating rich characters that respond to these extraordinary situations in hopefully unexpected and hopefully entertaining ways. And when I say entertaining, it's not necessarily ha-ha funny or oh boy, how exciting. It's also very emotional. That can be entertaining too. And then it's taking that seed and growing up the tree of what the plot is. That applies for rewrites as well. Now, 90% of your work in Hollywood is rewrites. 90% is assignments. Very few are original materials. So you're usually brought into an existing screenplay that the studio or the director feels or star feels needs some work. And oftentimes they won't be quite sure what that work is. I will give you just one example on Snow White and the Huntsman. I wrote The Huntsman, the sequel, but I did script work on Snow White and the Huntsman. And the character of Ravina, Charlize Theron's character, in the original screenplay has two brothers. And one of them is her enforcer. In the final movie, that character is played by Sam Spruill, fine British actor. The other character is the wizard. And when I read the script, I was like, well, what does she do? She just looks pretty. So I killed that kid, took that character out and made her the wizard. So now she only has one brother.
So in terms of your process, do you map out the whole story first? Do you find the ending? Do you write specific scenes to help you on the way? What is that part of the process?
Even if, whether it's original or rewrite, I always do a beat sheet. And so I know exactly where I'm going. And a beat sheet is basically something Disney taught me. And it's cute because it has titles. Each section, each sequence has a title that kind of emotionally or something triggers my memory on, oh, this is the content of the scene. So then I go into beats of here's what happens. Hopefully descriptive, but not too elaborate, because again, you want that room for happy accident and creativity to come in. But the beat sheet is the whole movie, and I know exactly where I'm going, which oftentimes saves me from confusion or writer's block.
Stick with this interview for more screenwriting secrets with Evan Spiliotopoulos. Now, if you're interested in film, there are interviews with a couple of other directors on the channel. Jonas Åkerlund, who was famous for his pop videos with Madonna, Lady Gaga, and Beyoncé, and has worked on film and series. And there's Steve Barron, who came up during the 80s. Michael Jackson's Billie Jean, Dire Straits, Money for Nothing, Aha's Take on Me, and even Madonna's first video, Burning Up. And he, of course, went on to direct films and series. Now, please subscribe. That helps me. And it will alert you when anything new comes up on the channel. And as I've said before, I'm trying to create an eclectic mix so there's something for everyone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
How do you approach collaboration?
It entirely depends. Well, it's always being open, basically, to input and notes and influence. But it entirely depends on the nature. For instance, I directed my first movie during the pandemic, which was an experience. But there, I was calling the shots as the director and writer. But it was a collaboration with the studio, with my actors, with my director of photography, and all those things. If it's a rewrite, then I'm specifically collaborating probably with the studio and sometimes with a director. Oftentimes they don't have a director and it's my draft that gets that person. So it just depends on who the players are. That's all.
So let's say not your own film. I want to come to that in, you know, the one that you wrote, produced and directed. But I want to talk about that you've written a movie and you're on set with a director and it's being filmed. And there are changes being asked for by actors who have a very high status or the director who has the highest status within the movie. So how do you make sure your voice is heard and how do you know when to say, okay, maybe I think my thing is better, but maybe I need to just say, okay, we go with that.
I have a trick that I shall tell you now. And the trick is this. First of all, I should say, in the heat of shooting, I've never experienced major changes, thankfully. It all happens in pre-production. I've heard that there are projects that do have major changes during production. Thankfully, I have not experienced that yet. I mean, we had some on my movie because pandemic, but we'll get to that. When the director asks for a new take on a scene, and it's something that I disagree with, my trick is this. I'm a very fast writer, so I will write the scene. And oftentimes the director will look at it because that gives them that opportunity to see the scene executed. And they'll be like, oh no, okay, what we had before is better. And it won't be you didn't write it well. That's never been told to me. It's always like, no, this is exactly what I asked for. Yeah, it doesn't work. Whereas if you do it slowly and then deliver it, there might be the danger of, oh my God, now we've taken so much time, they might want to film it. Whereas if it's boom, oh, yeah, okay, now we know. We can compare and all that good stuff. So that's the trick.
I mean, I presume that it's the director that talks directly to the actors and explains the background of the character and everything like that. But are you sometimes involved directly with the actors in terms of the characters, or are you communicating mainly with the director and then the director with the actors?
90% of the time, the latter. Sometimes I've been in the room with the director and the actors, and thankfully my opinion is asked for. But the rest of the time, it's always, even when we have a cast, it's always director, conversation, director goes off to actors.
Right. So these two films, The Huntsman, Winter's War, which you mentioned, and the Bill Condon directed Beauty and the Beast, they seem to be the films that solidified your position in Hollywood. Disney was a sort of process of feeling financially secure and learning the craft, or, you know, that taking you on that journey. One of the people you work with on The Huntsman, another writer, Craig Mason, and he wrote Chernobyl. Incredible writer. When we meet people, whether we're more experienced than them or not, there's always some form of exchange that we learn from each other. So what do you think that Craig Mason learned from you?
Fantasy. I hope. I met Craig. He's great. But Craig had never written a fairy tale. Craig, before Chernobyl, had been known for comedies, and specifically the Hangover sequels. The specs he had sold, to my knowledge, were mostly comedies. And he was brought into Huntsman because he had a great relationship with Universal. And he was basically brought in to make the characters more energetic and more fun. But he was working in my sandbox of this is the story. This is the story. So I'd like to think that, you know, an element of fantasy entered his realm because of our collaboration.
And what do you think you learned from him?
Timing of humor and also characters. Craig is a great character writer. And I think looking at what he did to Ravenna and Freya the Ice Queen and the Hemsworth and Chastain characters took them to another level and has probably informed my approach to character since then.
You talked about the unholy and that it came up during COVID, during lockdown, and you produce, wrote and directed this film. How important is that film, do you think, for your development in all three of those areas?
Well, in script, it wasn't so much. And I will say the reason is it was a book written by the late, great UK horror novelist James Herbert that I fell in love with when I was 13. And I carried around with me once my career in Hollywood began to ascend, Trying was the title, and he basically asked people to buy it for me so I could write it and adapt it. And I didn't really aim to direct it. I didn't have any directorial ambitions. And then what happened was, through circumstance, Screen Gems, which is the genre arm of Sony, decided to do it in 2019, and they were interested in having me direct it because they were in a place where they wanted known A-list writers to come in and execute scripts. And that was an experiment they were trying. And so as far as writing, not so much. And the rewrites that I had to do because of the pandemic, the circumstances were unique, but it wasn't anything that I wasn't used to doing the rewrites. It was my first job as a director. That was a learning experience. And I enjoyed the first half a lot more than the second half because... Well, just to clarify what happened. So we obviously didn't know there was a pandemic coming up. So we got into pre-production in January of 2020, and we started shooting in February of 2020. And then, of course, the pandemic hit, and 4 weeks into a seven-week shoot, we shut down. We were shooting in Massachusetts. We shut down. Everybody went to whatever their respective homes were, and Carrie always went to Scotland, and our wonderful Portuguese actor, Diego Morgado, went to Lisbon, and we scattered. And we sheltered, and myself and my editor assembled the movie virtually. We were at home in Hollywood, and we were looking at the footage, we assembled the movie. And thankfully, the studio wanted to finish it. And I say thankfully because any movies that were being shot under those circumstances, I don't know how many of them finished. I think we were one of three, maybe. So when the Massachusetts CDC in September of 2020 agreed to let us reopen, they gave us very strict conditions, and we couldn't have extras anymore, and we'd have to be in pods, and it was all for our own safety, and we did everything, but it made the shoot slower and infinitely tougher, infinitely, both physically and mentally for obvious reasons, physically because it was summertime now, and we were in hazmat suits. Like, I was wearing a garbage bag, a mask, a helmet, gloves up to like surgical gloves. Like, remember in Dead Ringers when Jeremy Irons is being given those, that red costume, a surgery costume, they would dress me like that every morning. There were times when I was beet red and like I didn't realize it. And my producer actually had to rent AC equipment, the private little R2-D2 AC units, and stick them in the tents so we could survive.
It's like a horror movie within a horror movie.
It's such a shame we didn't have a crew following us around and documenting it.
You mentioned James Herbert and the book that you read when you were 13, I think.
Yes.
What nuances did you discover by reading this book again and making this film as an adult?
Well, when I was a teenager, undoubtedly what struck me was the terror and the horror elements, undoubtedly. It has one of the best deaths I've ever read, which unfortunately we couldn't film because we had the edict of making it PG-13. That is my one complaint. But when I grew older and I was a writer and I wanted to adapt it, it wasn't the horror elements. It was all about how a miracle, what is our perception of a miracle? How not just the church, but the community can exploit the miracle and basically turn their community into a Disneyland, into a divine Disneyland to sell like candles and keychains and stuff like that, and how a miracle can get corrupted. So I just found it, I told everybody when we were filming, I found it a marriage of Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole to The Exorcist. And Ace in the Hole, of course, is this story about a journalist played by Kirk Douglas who discovers that in the aftermath of a mining accident, there are survivors still trapped in the mine, and he knows where they are, and he doesn't tell anyone because he wants to milk the story for as long as possible. So I felt it was this classic journalism expose character study of this one morally compromised man in the context of a horror movie.
Now, you've worked with Russell Crowe, one of the greatest actors, on Vatican Exorcist. Are you ever fazed by working with a star with such a high profile?
Not anymore. Basically, that all went away on Hercules, which was my first big live action movie, where I was invited to be on set for pre-production and production. So I was dealing with Dwayne Johnson and my favorites, Rufus Sewell and Rebecca Ferguson, on a daily basis. And now Rebecca wasn't Rebecca yet, but Rufus was, and Peter Mulan, and John Hurt, and Ian McShane. And I mean, once you do that for like 2 months of prep and then 3 months of filming, Charlize fazed me because she's Charlize. But ever since then, it's been fine.
I saw an interview with Matthew McConaughey, and he talked about when he gets a script and he looks at the script and he will possibly turn five lines into a movement or a, you know, some sort of facial expression or something. So what have you learned as a writer from actors?
Loosening up the dialogue, basically. So I've come to the place in the last 5 years, I would say, where when I'm writing a script, I actually act it out on myself. So I'll get up and I'll actually play out the scene, because I find that when you're just writing, there is a strictness and a tightness to the format that doesn't allow for looseness. And I don't want to be misunderstood that it's for comedies. It's for anything. When you're acting it out, you discover how a character will walk into a room instead of just saying, oh, what are you doing here? They'll be like, damn, it's hot in here. Shh. What? Didn't I tell you to turn to open the curtains? It's really stuffy. So there's suddenly becomes more real.
We talked about being the outsider, and in essence, you're now the insider. So how do you feed off the outsider today?
I will say without a shred of doubt that being a writer means you're always the outsider. Trust me on this. There's more to say. I mean, it's like, the insiders are the stars and the director. The outsiders are always, 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 always the writer. I don't care if you're a novelist, by the way. You're the outsider.
So there is no security as a writer?
None. I don't even mean specifically financial, although it's always, for writers, it's always a concern. I mean, you saw what happened with the strike last year, a completely necessary act that I hope protects us and has benefits. But a lot of people got hurt. And, you know, knock on wood, I'm better off than 99%, but a lot of people got hurt. And I'm not talking about that even, the financial part. I'm talking about the emotional part. I mean, being a writer means constantly being insecure, constantly. You've got an inner Woody Allen running around in you constantly.
When you look back at all the rejection and the hardship you had at the start in Los Angeles, and can you say to yourself how important that has been in the making of Ivan Stiliopoulos?
Well, it's the feeling of not taking anything for granted ever, because those struggles, yes, they also formed me as a writer, because they forced me when I was writing my specs during those years to work harder and harder and harder. Because when you start off here and you're told it's good, but it's just not good enough, well, you really want to get up here. And so I think I probably wouldn't have been hired by Disney if the writing of the spec that ultimately got me hired hadn't gone through that evolution, the way coal gets turned into a diamond, hopefully, that evolution of the hardships. But it also puts you in a position of saying, all fame is fleeting. What is it that they used to tell the Roman emperors when they would come in? Don't forget, you're still immortal, or something, when they would come back triumphant. So there is that constant concern of don't get too complacent.
Other advantages of being Greek in Hollywood, because only that Greeks have this love of food, you know, there's a sort of Greek society outside Greece, and there's not necessarily with every country do they have this close connection. So are there any advantages, and do you have contact with Greeks in Hollywood?
Select. So I have found, first of all, the perception of Hollywood towards me being Greek is great, because we're very, very likable as a nation, very likable. So I haven't met a single person who goes, oh, you're Greek? Oh, my God. It's like, oh, opa, we went to Mykonos for my honeymoon. We loved it. It's great. So that stuff's great. The other thing is, I didn't change my name on purpose. You know, it's a very long name that confuses people. But right away, when you see it, it's unforgettable. And the joke is, it sucks up the credits. So when I'm sharing with Craig Mazin, it's Evan Spiliotopoulos. That's actually a really embarrassing story, that I got co-story credit on Elizabeth Banks's Charlie's Angels. Elizabeth wrote the damn thing. So she got writing screenplay credit, and myself and Pulitzer Prize winner Dave Auburn shared story credit. And the posters were story by Evan Spiliotopoulos and David Auburn, directed by Elizabeth Banks. And it was embarrassing. That I was like, okay, fine. But in terms of my community here, I mean, honestly, you've interviewed Kid Moxie, who's one of my best friends in town. I have maybe three or four other Greek friends that I hang out with. The bigger community is the same with any foreign community in a town, which is there's a lot of struggle. And at some point, the drama becomes too much to deal with.
One thing that really interests me is because at the moment, one of the biggest directors in the world, Yorgos Lanthimos, who's also Greek, makes very unique, and he sort of carved his own niche. How do you view his work, and could you ever see a collaboration between you and Yorgos?
I think Scorsese had said about the auteur theory is that it's auteur is someone who you watch 30 seconds of their movie without knowing who directed it, and you immediately know who directed it. And as far as that's concerned, you can turn on any bit of a Yorgos Lanthimos movie and go, that's Yorgos. And he has been very, very, very successful critically and now commercially at what he does. In terms of collaboration, first of all, he has the best writer. So I don't think he'd be reaching out to me anytime soon. But we're different voices. I mean, I really am very mainstream. It is by intent and by the nature of what I write. I don't know if I would be able to serve a project that of his point of view to the way he's used to. I don't know if I could have written any of those, unless they were based on a book, which Poor Things was, of course. But there you go.
Recently, I talked to a pop star, Dr. Robert of the Blow Monkeys, who were big in the 90s. Yeah. And when he was young, his father died, and he said that his father dying in a weird way freed him from what his father wanted from his life. And I just wonder, coming to the close of this interview, whether in a sense that childhood trauma of your father dying actually freed you to be the person you are today.
A lot of children of Greek parentage and I think maybe European parentage in general, oh heck, and American, global parentage, oftentimes find themselves being shoehorned into the family business or following the footsteps of the dad or living the father's dreams and ambitions. This never happened with me. So my dad had always wanted me to pursue my own dreams. So as far as that's concerned, no. What it did do in purely practical terms is I probably had that tragedy not happened, I probably would be in Greece doing something. Like, I wouldn't have had the impetus or the opportunity perhaps to leave. And it's one of those things where it's like your life could have gone this way, but because of a very bad thing, it went this way that proved to be what you wanted to do. If you could go back and change that bad thing, would you? Which is a terrible moral question, which I've often asked myself, and I don't have the answer for it. But in terms of creatively, no. He was always like, you do your thing.
So what would you say to the young Ivan back then from the older person? What would you
keep
say?
Keep writing and start writing. Start writing sooner. Start
Brilliant.
Writing your 12.
Start writing sooner, and I say keep writing. Ivan Spiliotopoulos, I want to thank you because also for the contribution you have made to the culture, because it's incredibly important. It's something that enriches our lives, and we don't often get the chance to say a big thank you. I look forward to all the movies you're going to make in the future. I dare say there's going to be some direction and a few horror.
You dare say, possibly correctly. There's definitely that hope. So we shall see. Thank you very much.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.